to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. As Theosophists, we so declare the following. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of Theosophy, without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the Theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of Theosophy, and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among Theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among Theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as Theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true Theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. In the furtherance of this declaration, this lodge holds two public meetings, one on Wednesday evenings and on Sunday morning. Now, our Sunday programs are dedicated to a specific theosophical idea or concept, and this month, and today being the last of our Sunday meetings for the month.
No.
Oh, there's the 31st. How about that? And next week also included is Theosophy Approach to Everyday Ethics. And is this where our topic is? Personal and impersonal love?
Better be.
Uh-oh. Okay, and then in June, we will begin our study of practical theosophy. Now, on Wednesday evenings, we begin our class at 7:30 promptly, and we're over at 8:30 promptly. The doors open at 5:15 until 7:15. Then on Sundays, we have a class from 11 to 12, and the doors open at 10:30. And I think that's the announcements. Did we forget anything?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Oh, donations.
Donations.
Mm-hmm.
Empty your pockets, please, and put it in the tray.
I think that's called stealing.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, all the activities at this lodge are conducted on a voluntary basis of time, service, and money. All are welcome to participate. And whatever is given is used for the expression and keeping these doors open of the Theosophical movement. Now this morning, we're having a topic which is personal and impersonal love. And to begin this, personally, our first presentation.
Now, this subject, if you will stop and think about it for a minute, if you were trying to present it, how complicated it can be, but it's really complicated more by what we know and what we don't know about love. As an example, in our wired world today, we have access to personal information that we've never really known about before. And one of the most common things that you will see on social media is a new parent declaring, "The minute I saw my baby, I fell completely and madly in love." Now, mother or father, the amazing thing about that is they're acting as though no one ever told them that such a thing could exist. And yet we all know motherly love is commonly accepted. So it isn't real or it isn't love until we feel it, until we know it. Now the Greeks looked at this and looked at it very seriously and came up with 5 types of love. There's storge, which is parental love that we just spoke of. Mania. Like an obsession, the desire to own and possess something. Eros, all emotion for oneself is what they meant. In other words, I love how the way you make me feel. Philo, not emotional, not possessive, like love of wisdom. Philosophia, love of wisdom. And then agape, which is freely given and expects nothing in return. The highest type of love. But as theosophical students, we have to ask ourselves, what is the source of all this emotion? And the answer we are given is kama, K-A-M-A, desire or passion. And we're given this quote, "Kama is the first conscious, all-embracing desire for universal good, love, and for all that lives and feels, needs help and kindness, the first feeling of infinite, tender compassion and mercy that arose in the consciousness of the creative one force as soon as it came into life and being as a ray from the absolute." Kama then is a universal principle. It's in all of life. But in the individual, ourselves, thinkers in incarnation, only we have the choice to use it in either direction. We can use it as a personal passion or desire or an impersonal one. But then we come to the question, well, what do we mean by personal? What is the personal? Well, probably the easiest way is to remind ourselves that it is the personality, and that is an illusion. A temporary illusion that the mind of the incarnated thinker is trapped in a way, unless it works itself free, and it is that illusion is a product of karma, of the way we use our energy, our thoughts, our feeling in past living. In other words, we create for ourselves a condition that we will then, as a thinker, inhabit, and the mind is then dual, can go higher or lower, personal or impersonal. And again, we find 5 names. Only this time we go to India and take the Sanskrit names for the skandhas, the nerve of nature that go to make up this personality. Rupa, the material properties or attributes, our form and our physical condition. Vedana, sensations, whatever we feel, physical and emotional. Sana, abstract ideas, perceptions, thoughts, our likes and dislikes. Sankara, tendencies, both physical and mental. Will, intention, reactions, habits. And vinana, mental powers, the mental, physical, and moral predispositions, states of mind. Now you think about these five things, and you think, well, that's me. That's my attitude and how I feel and the things I like and the things I dislike. It's a temporary illusion brought on by our past use of physical, emotional life. We are shown in the Gita, in all the devotional books, just dwell for a while with the teachings of the Buddha. One of the most difficult things is to change your nature because you're working through a particular type of personality and striving to be above personality. It is the work of lifetimes and something that we are all about, whether it is just changing one habit or trying to find more time to be more self-reflective. Whatever is our particular individual approach, what we are trying to do is gain control of that personal nature to make it reflective of our real nature. And it is difficult. But then we do reach the awareness that it goes beyond difficult. And this is from the writings of a ULT student in the past. It is a thousandfold greater task to try to rise above the skandhas of the race. The whole Western world is almost overpoweringly affected by those collective skandhas that we call religion, science, and philosophy. The moment anyone endeavors to follow and hold fast to these ideas that we are spiritual beings who can alter and affect our conditions, we begin to face another plane, the skandhas of the class of reincarnating egos to which we belong. The skandhas really represent our unfinished business, the uncompleted actions and unlearned lessons of the past. In this effort to move from the personal to the impersonal, we have to study what the impersonal is, what it's like, and why we want it.
The purest example of this impersonal love is the sun, because it shines on all and it makes no distinction of any sort. It gives freely. So for us to understand the personal, we have to know what that impersonal is. And only from the impersonal can we see what the personal is. The soul is like a lamp in a room. And the image that's cast on or reflected from the walls is the mind. There's an analogy that we can use. There's this boat, this ship, that's been out at sea, and it comes to a port in the darkness of night. And when the day breaks, the captain sends out his first mate. Go into the town and gather this information for me, and please bring it back as quickly as possible. Well, the first mate goes out into the town, But lo and behold, he's just dazzled and mesmerized by all the shops and all the things that are found in cities. All this activity, all this excitement. And the first mate, well, he remembers that he came here for a purpose. So he gets back onto his task of fulfilling his assignment. But again, he is overcome with all the attractions and allurements of a city or of life. Well, the captain is our soul. The first mate is our mind. That to understand our impersonal nature can only be done one way. It has to gather information. It has to gather understanding and knowledge. Now, we are like this first mate. We have come into the world and we are dazzled by what we see and what we find in life. And oftentimes we think we are that. Well, the personality is the accumulation of all these experiences. All of them. But that is the personality. The personality is always, or gravitates downward. Impersonality gravitates upward. So, things are the results of life pass us by unless we become attached to the results. Now, how can we unite with this higher nature? Well, there's a word that is used called antaskarana. Well, it simply means bridge. It's a bridge to the higher, which is the mind. But the mind has to be in a state of impersonality. The only way we will understand our true spiritual nature. Because we have forgotten who we are. We have forgotten where we've come from. And our personality is a testament to that. Because we have become so engrossed in matter that we think we are matter. But we are not. We are divine in our true nature. Now, every theosophist or any person who reflects upon life is trying to unite himself with that higher nature. And the only way that is done is impersonally. And, of course, like the first mate going out into town and being waylaid by all these objects of sense is nothing more than karma. Nothing more than the results of prior living. So, the soul and the mind are like the lamp and its ray. To have unity with this higher self, we must have a plan. We must have a positive concept of the destination and clear knowledge that leads ahead. So we must travel with a map and a compass, strength and intelligence to adhere to this path. A definite purpose and a definite method by which that purpose is accomplished. We want to lead ourselves from that mind state into that soul state. Now we wonder that as theosophists, we come to these rooms and we are told that this knowledge, this love that is spoken of for humanity is what we need to engender. Now, we are told that, you know, to be impersonal does not mean to be cold and uncaring. That's not impersonal. Now, we need to feel a sense of gratitude, but also we have to feel that we are more than what these bodies are, that we are beyond all this, that the love that we show on a personal level has a source which is a part of that universal love. Because universal love that is impersonal is a love for everything, everyone, and all that exists. Now, to attain this impersonality, it's something we need to gather knowledge and information and search out the path. But we cannot separate ourselves from humanity, because that is our great cause. That is our duty. Not to find love or this universal love and hold it and keep it for ourselves and only give it to those who we love. That's personal. An impersonal love is to love those who hate us, to love those who challenge us, to love those who tolerate us. For if we love one another, we are fulfilling our duty to life. But we have to remember that the personality is the tool by which we gather information. It is that first mate that goes out into the world and gathers information, just like we have. But the problem is we are dazzled and bewildered and bewitched by everything around us. And we come away from it thinking, oh, that's who we are. That's what we are. We are not that which is changing. Our love is unchanging, is eternal, is boundless, immutable, and omnipresent. We need to shine like that sun, which we see in the sky, but is only a reflection of that great sun from which all life comes. So we cannot forget the source of our life. And to be impersonal, we have to look at things as if, oh, karma, oh, that's bad. Oh, that's good. Oh, heck, I just want to forget about it. No. Karma is a gift from the universe. It's giving us back with love that which we need, that which we have taken out of harmony and called it our own, but it isn't. We own nothing in this world. Nothing that we see we can hold on to. There's only one thing that we can hold on to. That is that unchanging attitude and mindfulness that is the soul itself. So to understand true love, one must understand that immortal aspect that dwells within everyone. When we look into someone's eyes, what do we see? We see ourselves reflect back. And it is the hardest thing to love those who do not love back, to love those who are ignorant, to love those who are not searching for the truth, but are bewildered by the dazzle and the excitement of life. And they no longer understand what their mission is. That we all have a duty. We all have a duty to each other and to humanity and to life. And when we forget that duty, we cut ourselves off from everything. Like we love each other, we need to expand that love for everyone. And personally, it's with great difficulty that we become unattached to those actions which we find comforting and exhilarating. We are pointed to the Bhagavad Gita from the beginning to the end. Is how we become this eternal pilgrim consciously. We cannot look for the results of our actions. We cannot be cast down or elevated by the experiences of life. We have to give up the results of our actions. The only thing that will free us from what we have created, we have to become unattached to what we do and say and feel and sacrifice it to that higher nature, which is the same in all of us. That is what makes us a universal brotherhood. It is love to its greatest degree. We will stop there and give you a chance to love us back.
But that always equals the opposite could occur.
Yes, but yes. We won't accept that.
We'll take indifference.
We'll be unattached to that action. Yes.
We think, first of all, it's important to know that it is a universal principle. It is not something that begins with a physical or an emotional response. It's as present in the empty air and the atom as it is in you or me. The atom, the mineral, the vegetable, the animal, they can't choose how they will use that principle. They live by impression. They register and react to the impression that comes from within their own intelligence. Thus, if you deal with one fox or wolf, you know what it's most likely another fox or wolf will do. That is not true with humans. First, because we can choose how we will use that feeling, that universal expression of love, of feeling connected with everything. We can choose to limit it and use it just for me, or just for mine, or just for those who look like me or think like me. No one and nothing else in the universe can do that. So we have to ask ourselves, why? Why do we have the choice of personal and impersonal? And that is the basis for learning and growth. We're right back to the Bhagavad Gita.
Mm-hmm. We always go back to the Bhagavad Gita. Mm-hmm. You know, for us, we know what love is. We know the feeling. We know what it can do on this plane. Jealousy, selfishness, separateness. When we realize that, we come to think, well, this isn't going to work out.
Mm-hmm.
Because my heart is broken constantly by this attachment to this physical love. But as we begin to understand that there's something greater than that. This impersonal idea is the only way we can truly see the personal. If we do not rise above it, we become lost. We become bewildered. We think we are what we see. We are what we feel. We are what we do. No, we're mistaken. Our mind has been overcome with life itself. One must center the mind. One must quiet the mind. One must make the mind impersonal. Then we begin to find really what life is truly all about. If we didn't love, we wouldn't know what love is. But Buddha taught us what true love is. It is compassion. Compassion for all that lives.
Yeah.
Personally speaking.
Well, if we didn't do that yet, we don't think we could ever do it. It is simply a question of a mind alive and at work. And if it is focused on itself, its needs, its wants, to the exclusion of and competition with everyone else, it is acting on a personal basis. And it might have been many lifetimes of building that up. But because we are the individuality, all we're seeing is that top of the iceberg, the fault that mind has to work out. In other words, we may have a terrible problem, whatever it is, something in our nature that is rotten or sour or difficult, and we can't get along with anybody. Let us take the steps, the remedial steps, through compassion and caring about others, as that fault falls away and the individuality can shine through. We may be light years ahead of the people around us, but we don't know it because we're blocked by something negative that we have created. But that's not the most important issue. The issue is, what will we do with the wisdom we discover? Because we can use wisdom in a personal and selfish way. So the individual is the chooser and can go in either direction.
So the personality becomes the accumulation of these experiences that we are presented with in life. And therefore, the illusion arises that we are this. But it's said again and again, who is the witness of all of this? It is said that the true self sees but truth and duty. Our mission in this lifetime, and probably in lifetimes past, is to gain knowledge, to gain understanding, to gain a realization of who and what we are. We are not the personality. We can't emphasize that enough. No, it's a tool which we use to interact with others, but we can't be attached to it. It's only a tool. When we think we are that, we see how those personalities become lost because they are always striving for power and position, selfishness and separateness. We see it in the world in which we live, and we're all heartbroken.
I just want to jump in with this. You spoke of gaining knowledge and awareness. This is a quote from Mahatma Gandhi that I think, especially in this time in our civilization, it is important to reflect on this. Gandhi said, "When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time, they seem invincible. But in the end, they always fail. Think of it, always." In other words, love and good and truth will prevail.
And another quote from Sophocles. "One word frees us all." Oh, I'm sorry. "One word frees us of all the weight and pain of life. That word is love."
How does the concept, the dogma of vicarious atonement keep us from freely loving all in an impersonal, in other words, agape, the highest love?
Well, you know, the concept is not wrong. Atonement, at-one-ment, the idea that you put yourself in harmony with life, with love, with truth, with goodness. The difference is when it's a dogma, you're giving the task to somebody else. And they are the one you look to believe in, or to assume that grace will be given to you. It is self-induced and self-devised. We are, and we think this is one of the hardest concepts for any one of us to really handle. Look within. Thou art Buddha. You are the highest being in the universe. You just don't know it. And the highest beings continue to make an effort for us to have the information so we can know if you would just wake up from this sleep of being the first mate and being dazzled and in love with everything you see around you, if you would wake up, you would realize you are that power. You are that force, and you have to bring that into at-one-ment. No one can do it for you or through you.
It alludes to the idea that we are responsible. We are the only one that is responsible for what comes to us. It's not our parents' fault. It's not our brothers' or sisters' fault. And it's not even a fault. It's just an opportunity. Life brings us opportunity after opportunity. When we close our eyes and say, That's not my fault. I'm not even going to deal with that one. We are setting up a roadblock because we have within our mind a false idea. The true idea is that we are an accumulation of experiences from many, many lives. We know the truth. We know what our duty is. We know all these things, but we have forgotten them because we have become engrossed in darkness or matter. And it's said that we are beginning our upward climb back into spirituality. So it's said also that we will be given more and more opportunity to recognize that soul within. And when we recognize it, we need to do our duty to it and for it. And another quote from Mahatma Gandhi: the day the power of love overrules the love of power, the world will know peace. Right here. Yes.
It's been said before that.
Can you speak up, please?
It's been said that we're here to become conscious. Okay, and I just wanted to say to you that what you just talked about is like, to me, it was like you actually detailed what consciousness is. And I just want to thank you.
Well, we have to remember that all of life is conscious. Everything in life is conscious. Things we don't see are conscious. I mean, there's a whole world around us that is invisible, but it's conscious. The only self-conscious being is man. And from this high point, from the top of this pyramid, we affect everything below us, sometimes directly, but mostly indirectly, because it's a ripple effect. It's a vibration that is sent out into the world. We think, who's going to even know that? I'm going to do this in secret. There's no secrets. Your soul is the witness, and it carries with it, and it tries to assimilate the experiences of life. But again, it cannot assimilate that which it is not. That true self is love and duty. And once we recognize that, we can begin to nurture that. And there are, again, we point to the Gita. If we do anything in this lifetime, the one thing that we should do is read and study the Bhagavad Gita. Because there is no simpler treatise on how to become an immortal being on this plane of manifestation. But it is only through self-induced and self-devised means that we can do it.
And to take your question in a more mundane way, one of the things that we can begin to prove to ourselves about consciousness is spend a week registering, I am conscious of my feeling when I deal with this person, my feeling when the bus is late, my feeling with this task I've been asked to do that I don't want to do. I'm not going to change any of them. I'm going to be conscious of me and my reaction in them. And then I will realize, wait a minute, this is like a template. If this is how I'm thinking, this is how I'm going to act. Is that what I want? Oh, okay. Pick one of the things and say, I am for a week going to do that differently and see how it affects my consciousness. And we will discover that it affects everything about us, our digestion, our sleep, the way others react to us and feel about us. And that's when we understand the Buddha's teaching, change one fault and the ramifications of that fault move all the way through every aspect of your life, every aspect of your personal nature. So becoming conscious is the most important thing we think that you can do. And the Gita, of course, is the textbook of that. Way in the back, she had her hand up.
We were thinking of an example where it had talked earlier about someone we have, we don't want to say we hate them, but we have a great dislike. And there's no reasonable
present
purpose for this. We just can't stand to be in their presence, and we realize, and we were working with them at the time, and we realize, okay, this person's part of my karma, or he wouldn't be here. I can continue to get digestion every time I see him, or I can decide to learn how to, at the time I said like, but it would be love him. And it took a very long time. And every time he saw me and greeted me, I tried to be a little kinder in my response. Now if I see him on the street, we hug and kiss and, you know, reminisce about the days that we worked together. It really works, but you have to put a lot of energy in it.
Well, you have to remember, I think we read in our Wednesday class that the brain is a dynamic generator of force and power. But we also were attached to each other by invisible threads of magnetism and electricity. So how we feel is radiating out from us. And those that we resist attach themselves to us. If we are in conflict with someone, we have a certain feeling we hold on to. But the moment we give that feeling up and say, that is not who I am, that is not what I am, I do not want to have this feeling, because certainly I don't want to be attached to this person in that way. So we try, and that's all we can do, is try, not to be attached to those objects of sense.
And to develop a sense of humor.
Yes.
Because it is pretty comical, isn't it? Two spiritual beings meeting each other and not liking each other? We're the power of life. We have no limit on the potential of our powers except the ones that we put there, and we put them there by choice because we like this personal life.
How does one go about loving someone who is in direct opposition to your existence and means you harm?
Mm-hmm.
How do you reconcile that when natural instincts is self-preservation?
Well, first there's the realization that our natural instinct is wacko. I mean, it really is. How can we have an instinct for self-preservation when we are the self? We cannot be destroyed. The instrument that we have can be destroyed, but guess what? We'll probably get a better one because we finished with that karma. So that instinct that we call natural is not natural to the soul. The desire to have harmony is natural. The difficulty in meeting the enemy or the adversary that way is that we want resolution. We want either our all-encompassing good feeling to swamp them and they suddenly have a conversion, which is ridiculous because that's not how we came to knowledge through a moment like that, but a step by step. So instead of focusing on what we don't like about them or their attitude, their behavior, we focus on, I am identical to you. And in some life, I must have taken the position you are now taking because I understand it completely. And in order to know something, you have to have lived through it. So I forgive you for your present ignorance, just as I forgive myself for my ignorance about things, and let the other go and grow as they will. They're not the enemy. They're an undigested part of life.
And knowledge that we gain tells us again and again, resist not evil. Do not give it energy. Do not make it more than what it is. Resist it not. It is not yours. And that, we, as was said, we have to train the mind to be accepting and knowing that people act out of ignorance. And if they knew the truth and they wanted the truth, this world would be a lot different. And guess what? It will be.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not in this lifetime, but as long as we keep on working, we will see it in one lifetime.
Sir?
So, listening to the gentleman's question.
No, I can barely hear you.
Okay, so just listening to the gentleman's question there, an external adversary, I find the adversary is internal in that the weight of the matter and the desires of the matter and the urgencies of the lower self often conflicts with the goals of the higher self.
Well, of course, that's the whole job, isn't it? If
right.
It were easy, would you do it?
Well, and therein lies the rub, because like when you think of matters of financial security and matters of, you know, quote unquote practical living, a lot of times it's juxtaposed to the spiritual. It seems juxtaposed to the spiritual.
Let me interrupt you for a second. The student of theosophy who founded the United Lodge, which is based strictly on voluntary donations, not even passing the hat. It's impossible, right? And it's only been in existence since 1909. It could fail any minute, right? From lack of support. He lost everything. He walked away from everything. All of his money, all of his background, all of his friends, everything. He lost all security of life and went and got a job, a very menial job, in order to dedicate himself to doing what he felt was right. And that was bringing the original writings of theosophy back to a starving world. Well, if he'd had that fear about a loss of security, he couldn't have done it. What did he base his action on? I'm a spiritual being. If I starve to death, what starved to death is my body. Now, certainly, if he had small children to take care of, that would be a different approach. But the fact is, we have nothing to fear. Anything that comes to us is on this plane for us to learn from, but we go within into our own spiritual nature in order to digest and to assimilate that. So the fact that things seem overwhelming, what we have to do is quiet, the mind, meditate if we can, read devotional books, trust life. We are life. We cannot be harmed or destroyed. Trust that. It isn't easy, but it is worth discovering.
And we have to remember that we live in a world whose values have been turned upside down. So we are told what is the good life. We are told how to live that good life. We are told constantly what is real and what is not real. We have to learn to discriminate. We have to learn to recognize that eternal aspect, because really this lifetime is but a blink of an eye, if it is even that. We must remain on the path, even though we struggle, even though we fall back. We must get up again and not work for ourselves, but work for others.
There's the secret, attitude. Our attitude in facing failure is more important than having been successful, because that's how we grow. If our attitude is fitting, then we will carry the result.
Speaking of attitude, go ahead.
Okay. According to the philosophy, is it true that whatever attributes exist within the race mind, also exist in us, at least in germ, and that all that is necessary for that germ to sprout is the right conditions? And if so, can we eliminate that germ completely?
Well, that is one of the things that we are told to do, is an inspection of ourselves. That's a use of consciousness. I mean, literally, draw a line down a piece of paper and put your assets over here. I am frugal. I am whatever. I can type. And then over here, you put down, I talk too much. I am selfish about this or that. So you're looking at an honest depiction of your current moment. You keep that and see if you can change any of them. But you add to it, you meet someone and they bring out a different response in you. And you realize, oh, I have the germ of that fault. I've never looked at it. I've never worked on it. And you can begin working on it. But equally, you will discover good qualities you didn't even know you had, because they were never challenged. So don't forget, the good of the race is in you too. And it may not be just germ. It may be a full-blown plant, but you can't harvest it at this moment because of the particular faults in your way. We're here to work on our faults, not to revel in and enjoy our qualities, our good, already done, accomplished things. So it's a very exciting realization. Yes?
Is there a list somewhere, or should we just start with the seven deadly sins?
Well, first of all, they're not deadly. That's an important thing to realize. You cannot kill the soul. And you don't need a list. You've got your own mind. Open the door, walk in. It's just about the end of our time, and we'd like to do just a couple of quotes. Chesterton said, "The Bible tells us to love our neighbors and also to love our enemies, probably because generally they're the same people." And Mark Twain said, "After all these years, I see that I was mistaken about Eve in the beginning. It is better to live outside the garden with her than inside it without her." And a quote from a student's writing, "Finite personal love is not bad in itself, but it is frustrating and useless to the human soul unless it can gradually purify and make more impersonal and unselfish that force of karma in its incarnated personality. Personal love we should allow to expand and grow into impersonal love. Meeting is adjourned.